This is the worst podcast I've ever been on.
These guys are shit. It's true. It's true.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Our traveling fanboys. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another edition of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. We're coming to you from Ho-Ho Loon Plaza, beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, the L-shaped studio. I am Greg Phillips. With me, as always, is my cohort, my partner in crime. I think that was a brief appearance by JR there for a moment there. My partner in crime, good old Nick Dute.
Hi there.
Big time.
Yep, there it is.
You know, folks, there's a lot going on in the world of the Hard Traveling Fanboys. I mean, we're dealing right now with oppressive heat.
Oh, my God, dude. It's like we always forget because, you know, June, July, the magical time of June, July gets here, and you and I bitch about the heat the entire time. And what happens every time, Greg, and we even talked about this as it was happening. I was like, oh, this is exactly what's happening, but in a joking fashion. Like, early August comes, and it cools down, like, just a bit. Just, like, a tiny bit. And what happens is, like, a week later after that happens, it gets even hotter and more humid than it was for the entirety of June and July. And now it's like, you walk outside, and you just instantly start sweating, which I know isn't unusual for you, but the rest of us start sweating instantly when we walk outside. It sucks, man. It's the worst right now.
And even now, even though we work inside jobs, I mean, just the fact that we have to ever walk outside is bad
right.
enough.
Yeah.
You like, don't understand no. how hard it is to be the hard traveling fanboys.
That's right. I got paid to go buy ice cream at my job the other day, but I had to walk 3 blocks to get the ice cream.
Ugh.
You don't understand.
Well, nonetheless,
cute text messages saying they don't get the point of us talking about how hard it is to be us.
I just don't understand what it's leading to.
Entertainment. It's leading to entertainment.
Exactly. Well, we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about other forms of entertainment. Because we are bringing to you an episode of Off the Page.
Yes.
And as you know, this month is a part of our very special and very rare nowadays non-theme month.
That's right.
So that means we were open to try anything we wanted, Nick. And so what did we choose to do? Well, AMC is premiering this month the fourth and final season of Preacher.
Yes.
A show that Nick and I consumed weekly in its first season and then promptly stopped consuming afterwards.
That's not entirely true. I watched about half of season two before I fell off. It just got caught up in the landscape of, you know, because I think it came back around the same time. So it's right there as our other stories are preparing to come back and football season starts for me. And it's just a lot going on at one time. But I think I remember you and I were so excited. We actually did a special edition of the podcast. We reviewed the very first episode back when this when it aired. So, and we talked about season one extensively here on the show at that point. I think we were pretty much in agreement that we had issues with the show. I mean, I think I was a little bit higher on the show in general than you were, but we both had pretty severe issues with some of the characterization, some of the writing, some of the pacing, particularly as it involved the character of Tulip. So season, you know, that probably played a part in, you know, you dropping off before season two. And I'll say, as we'll discuss throughout this podcast, I think season two, what I've seen of it anyway, proved to be an improvement over that first season.
Well, that is indeed why we're here today, because we are here to review the first episode of season two of Preacher. We're going back and kind of picking up where I left off, and Nick had forgotten really a lot of pretty much everything that had happened in here. And I found season one of Preacher to be interesting in that I did have severe issues with it. I had problems with the pacing. I thought that it kind of corrected itself a little bit towards the end. I thought the certainly Jackie Earle Haley coming in as Odin Kincannon was a breath of fresh air.
And I had been pronouncing it Quincannon for the entirety of our friendship until the show came along and informed us we were idiots.
We were idiots, yes. Which happens a lot with pronunciations of things for us. You see, we come from a place in America called the South, and at times we've been known to mispronounce things. So, in any event, we learned we were wrong about that, and I thought the show kind of course corrected a little bit towards the end. I don't remember my thoughts on the first season finale, but I think I did have some issues with it, although I can't remember for sure. But nonetheless, we're here to talk about the first episode of the second season. And while Nick has already sort of told a little bit of a tale out of skewl about it, I would tend to agree with his analysis for the most part that at least the first episode here of season two rights a lot of the wrongs that we saw in the first the maiden voyage of this TV show, if you will. So, with all that being said, we are going to do what we always do with Off the Page when we watch a TV show or a movie. We are going to allow you a chance, if you so choose, to watch along with us. So again, we're firing up Season 2, Episode 1 of Preacher, and it is currently available to stream on Hulu if you have that service. Of course, you may also have the DVD or the Blu-ray of this season. Regardless, take the time now, pause the podcast, and get your media player of choice ready if you so choose to watch along with us. And I am going to count us down into the episode, assuming my remote control works. And I am going to hit the play button in 3, 2, 1, play. The following is intended only for mature audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
Oh, Steve, I already passed. You already saw that part, so I'm on to the AMC original series.
Whatever. Nonetheless, that notwithstanding, it'll be a real Donnybrook. The search for God, we're seeing flash across the stage here. So there's this first episode is kind of divided into chapters. And we open up here with a picture of Jesse Custer, Tulip O'Hare, and Cassidy the Vampire, as they're all cruising along in a car, playing some tunes on the radio, talking about severed penises and foreskins, which in and of itself could be a funny concept. However, Nick, I think I told you during our lunchtime conversation today, this whole opening scene I didn't really like. I didn't find it very funny. I didn't find the dialogue to be Preacher-level funny. And I think I was into the – and I'll be honest with you, I realized this as I'm watching it. One of the things that took me out of the scene early was I had to readjust to Ruth Negga's accent as Tulip.
Yes. You there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'd completed my point and was waiting on you to respond.
Sorry, it kind of cut out there for a second. Yeah, I mean, I like this opening scene. They're going to get here to a little bit. Not really for the content of what they're saying, but more because it seems like the interplay between the three of them. Because my memory of season one is that you didn't have all three of them on screen together a whole lot. You kind of had Jesse and Tulip, or Jesse and Cassidy, or Tulip and Cassidy, but very rarely did you have the big three together. And that was kind of the dynamic that drove Preacher as a comic series. So, you know, we've talked about that a lot. The pacing of season one felt like it was so drawn out, and it felt like they were adding this unnecessary prologue to the story of the comics. You know, just all of this backstory we had to get through to get to the actual Preacher adaptation we wanted to see. And so to me, starting off the season with these three in a car together, having a discussion about random bullshit, and then getting into a fun little bit here about Come On Eileen, a song that Cassidy claims to think is shite and yet starts bobbing his head and singing along to.
Mm-hmm.
it's more for the interplay between the three rather than the content of what they're saying, I could appreciate this scene.
And that's certainly fair. I'm not going to begrudge one that, but it was jarring for me at first. And as I mentioned, I think one of the reasons it was jarring is because of the accent of Ruth Negga as Tulip, which was one of the impediments to me in season one. Is Tulip just didn't seem anything like I read her in the comics, mm-hmm. and I think I adjusted to that quicker on season two than I did in season one. Whereas I think they kind of fixed some of her characterization in this episode.
Immensely.
And throughout even though the dialogue, even though the dialogue didn't work for me and the accent might never work for me because it just doesn't sound the way that I imagined Tulip sounding reading the comic. And being in the South, I'm probably a little more sensitive to Southern accents with regards to accuracy and regionality and all that stuff. But that being said, better tone, I think. Better mm-hmm. characterizations, as you put it earlier.
Yeah, the tone, absolutely. I mean, because you got this comedic, you know, kind of musical bit set against this traditionally shot, conventionally created car chase. Not using practical effects, not overly CGI'd with explosions and, you know, cars that look fake. It even drops into like 70s style film stock here to signify kind of what they're going for. And I appreciate this scene. It doesn't overstay its welcome to me. It kind of gets into something a little bit more preachery here in just a second. But I liked the opening bit.
I was going to say, that's the other thing. I was going back and forth on this earlier, and I think I've settled on I kind of don't like going to this film stock here because it doesn't feel like preacher. It feels like, I don't know, something fourth wall breaking. And I don't really think that was ever Preacher's deal, really. I think that's more of a Grant Morrison kind of vibe, you know? But luckily, that was a very brief scene, and everything from here on out in the episode is really good, actually. Including all of this stuff with Cassidy being tackled. He can't be in the sunlight, you know?
After I saw this second... the first episode of the second season, it flashed back to me, you know, despite the issues you and I have with season one, we were unanimous in our praise of, I believe it's Joseph Gilgan as Cassidy, because he was outstanding. And watching this episode again reminded me of just how good he was on this show and is. It makes me want to catch up.
Oh, absolutely. Gilgan is pitch perfect as Cassidy, who is a lot of people's favorite character from the comic book series. He was a pretty much a breakout from the minute you start reading Preacher. Cassidy is instantly one of the stars of the book from the minute that he appears. And certainly I think Joseph Gilgan, more so than Dominic Cooper and Ruth Negga, really inhabits the character as he is on the printed page, and carries that through to the big screen. And That was sort of – because this is a show that's really kind of doing its own thing with Preacher. You know, it is following the basic guidelines of the book and the tone at times of the book, but it's very much doing its own thing with the characterizations and the way that it's getting from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So I think Joseph Gilgan is kind of that throwing a bone maybe to the comic book fan of saying, this is exactly what Cassidy is like on the page, how I read Cassidy, what he looks like, everything under the sun. Whereas Dominic Cooper, who is a good Jesse Custer, isn't necessarily like the Jesse Custer 100% that we see on the page. I don't get the sort of vibe from him that he could just kick my ass at any given time that he wants to. You know, that I get off of the.
They should have at least taken Psycho Sid's hair and put it onto what's this fuck's name? I've already forgotten. Dominic Cooper. And dyed it black. Because he really does. I mean, in the comic, Jesse Custer has Psycho Sid hair.
Yeah, yeah. And in fact, if they could have just cast Psycho Sid, who's from West Memphis, Arkansas,
And every time he uses Genesis, he talks through his teeth.
Yeah. Hey, Genesis! I need to tell these people to spray their dicks with pepper spray!
This is a good opening scene, though. Once you get through the cart,
awesome. And it's so violent.
Yeah,
this is awesome. One of the hallmarks, if you've never read Preacher, one of the hallmarks of Preacher is the just overwhelming amount of violence.
I must have missed that when I watched it the other night.
Did you just see the guy's top half of his skull explode?
Top half of his skull got blown off. I remember the intestine bit. I didn't remember the top half of the head exploding.
So Steve Dillon's art throughout the Preacher series is just, and it increases, it ramps up as the series goes on, and it's so violent and so over the top and ridiculous. And the show in season two embraces that from the get go. I mean, we're not even 10 minutes into this episode, and we've seen a skull explode. In a few moments, we're going to see a car roll over a guy's skull and crush it slowly. We're going to see intestines hanging out the back of a car. There is no line that this show won't cross, and that's appropriate given the source material.
At times, it's a little surprising that they could even get away with this on AMC. I mean, like...
Oh, totally.
When they first started talking about a preacher television show, I think that was one of our biggest concerns, is even on AMC, could they do the things that you kind of needed to do, not just with violence, but like with just content, like sexual content, religious content, the envelope pushing they would have to do. And for the most part, I mean, they've gotten away with it.
Oh, totally. And the way they – I was also – we were both concerned of how would they illustrate Genesis, because Jesse doesn't use Genesis for most of season one. And how are they going to put that across? How are they going to show that ability? And it's perfect, actually. He talks. He's got a different voice when he talks with Genesis, an amplified voice. And he makes people do the most ridiculous things, like the guy that he made recite the Yellow Rose of Texas just now.
I have not gotten this far, but I hope at some point he makes somebody count all the grains of sand on the beach.
Oh, my God.
That was my favorite, like, one. Because then I think later on, like, three issues later, they come back to a flashback, and a gust of wind blows the entire pile away, and you just see the guy, like, having a mental breakdown.
Yep.
One of my favorite bits.
Oh,
yep.
so nasty. I think Steve Dillon would be proud of this show in its imagery, at least in season two, to start things off.
That's a good shot.
So yeah, I mentioned Dominic Cooper earlier. Jesse Custer is the lead character in Preacher, and I mentioned that he is a little bit different, not just in the Osborne-like unique hair. That they don't have in the show. But Cooper's Jesse is a little more vulnerable, I think, than the comic book Jesse. A little more... Unsure of himself than comic book Jesse. He doesn't have the sort of philosophical bent that comic book Jesse has, or the idol worship of John Wayne and of... who was the comedian that Jesse Custer worshipped in the comic? Bill Hicks.
Bill Hicks, yeah. I mean, in the comics... Pretty much once he just makes the decision to leave his parish, he is fully convinced of the man that he is and that he wants to be. This, because of the entire extended, you know, prologue, as we said, in season one, you get to see him wrestling with that a lot more, and he still feels, as you said, very conflicted. Again, I've only seen about half of season two, and I don't remember it that well, but I want to say they start to course correct on that even a little bit as well throughout the early part of season two.
Who is this actor that's playing the old man here?
I have no idea.
I feel like I've seen him in something before. It drove me nuts last night, and I have not had the gumption to actually look it up, but gosh, I don't know. I've seen him in something, but no, this is another great bit here with the gas station owner and Jesse telling him to pretend they're not there, which ends up, unfortunately, costing this guy his life in a few minutes. But yeah, what are your thoughts on Dominic Cooper and how he portrays Jesse? I feel like he's better here than he was at points in season one. It is a different Jesse, but he does a good job of portraying him.
Well, I think if you're comparing him to his other two co-leads, which I think is inevitable, he falls in the middle. You know, it's impossible, I think, for someone to capture the essence of a comic book character as well as Gilgan does as Cassidy. But, as you said, Dominic Cooper is getting closer here. And whether it be through her fault or the fault of the writers, he certainly isn't struggling to find the voice of the character the way that I think Ruth Negga is, even though she's better here in season two. There are moments where it doesn't feel like Jesse, but there are also moments in every episode that remind me of, yeah, this is the Jesse Custer I know and love. And that wasn't always the case with Nega as Tulip in the episodes that I've seen. So somewhere in between those two, but trending upward, I would say.
Certainly. And Nega, who also we should mention has been in she was an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. at one point as well. She's a good actress, and she does a good job of portraying this sort of headstrong Tulip that we know from the comics. But it's just a different sort of vibe from her on this show than it was in the comic. And maybe that corrects itself again moving forward. Better here, but kind of baby steps forward, mm-hmm. I think. So the other character who we haven't been introduced yet to in this episode, we're about to be, that we have to talk about, in my opinion, maybe the best thing that this show has done to this point. Mm-hmm. And that is Graham McTavish as the Saint of Killers.
Yes.
Saint of Killers episode in season one was by far my favorite episode mm-hmm. of the first season of Preacher. And we see him show up here like a hound from hell. And damn if it isn't every bit what it should be. It is exactly how one would imagine the Saint of Killers being ideally handled. It's the equivalent of when there's like a major wrestling signing and you think to yourself, WWE will never use this guy the way that they should, but if they did, here's how they should do it. And then it happens. That's this. That's exactly this. This guy shows up, and a great comparison, Nick, and it's impossible not to think about this if you're a wrestling fan. Did it not look like The Undertaker making his walk to the ring at
times? A little bit, yeah. Very slow and purposeful. And that was always the way in the comics. He never hurried after Jesse because he knew that he would get there eventually.
Exactly. And it's like that, much like The Undertaker throughout most of his career, it's that feeling of inevitability that, you know, he's taking his time because there's not a damn thing you can do to stop him, you know?
Right.
And that's kind of what we're seeing with the Saint of Killers. He shows up and he wrecks everybody's shit, essentially. And there's nothing that anyone can do to stop him from what he does. Like, he is inevitable. And, you know, Thanos may think he's inevitable, but the Saint of Killers truly is. And the portrayal is so stoic and so emotionless, but also seething with rage, which is how I always read the Saint in the mm-hmm. comic. I always thought of him as being a character who doesn't betray any emotion, but underneath is bubbling with rage. And that's exactly the vibe that I get from this guy. I don't know this actor very well, Graham McTavish, but he truly portrays, I think, Nick, that that rage that is constantly bubbling up underneath.
I absolutely agree.
Apparently, he is also known for his role as Dwalin in the Hobbit film trilogy.
He was, Dwalin. I don't know. One of the hobbits in the Hobbit film trilogy. But the problem is, they're all under such heavy prosthetics, I wouldn't be able to recognize him. And they all run together anyway, because there's literally like a dozen of them, a dozen dwarves in those movies.
Oh, and this poor old fat man's getting his tongue ripped out.
Mm.
Man.
No spelling coconut for him, I see.
I don't follow.
There's a current internet trend going around that's saying that is saying the most effective way to perform oral sex on a female is to spell coconut during the act.
To spell it
with your tongue, you know, like make the tongue motions, Greg.
Oh, I'm trying to do it now, and it's strange.
Oh, don't do it by yourself. One should never cunnilingus alone.
Well,
we've gone off the rails here, folks.
In record time.
Yes.
Actually, probably not record time.
No. We made it a good solid 20 minutes. I think we did okay.
We're doing all right.
And if you don't like it, fire us. We're already fired.
If you don't like it. Actually, I got a good line here to quote a great man. If you don't like it, tough shit. So we get to also meet this mentor figure in this episode, a mentor of Jesse Custer.
Now, this dude looks familiar to me, but I can't remember who he is.
And he is a character. I think this is an original character, is he not?
Yeah, I'm talking about the actor.
Yeah. No, I know, but I'm asking about the. I don't know the actor's name, but I am asking about the character. It's an original character, I believe, is it not?
I believe so. I remember in the book they went to see one of Cassidy's friends who claimed to be something of an expert on like religious investigations, but he was not a pastor. So this is. I think it takes some hints from that, but is ultimately an original creation.
And this I thought was really funny. This whole bit where they find this girl in a cage, and then the guy shows up and says, "Just mind your own business. Come on over." and then Tulip, probably the best Tulip moment of the episode. She does say sorry and just drops the blanket back over the girl that's locked in the cage.
Yes.
Which we later find out that this preacher, in order to protect people from their urges and sins, he agrees to lock them of their own volition in these cages.
In these covered cages, yes.
To keep them from their sins. And it's certainly an original creation of the show and a really funny one at that. So yeah. Kudos to Seth Rogen and Evan – what is it? Evan
– Goldberg.
Goldberg, yes. Who had a big win this past weekend over Dolph Ziggler, I understand. So kudos
to – this ain't the wrestling minute.
Kudos to both of them for their work on this show and coming up with some pretty clever original ideas that don't feel out of touch with what Garth Ennis would do. Mm-hmm. They're about to uncover this this poor young lady. Well, she's not really poor, I guess. But yeah, so we also find out that this guy was a friend of Jesse's dad, John Custer, who I can't remember if we actually see in season one.
Yeah, I think in some of the flashbacks we do, because I remember there was he was the pastor in the town before Jesse was.
Oh, that's right.
Remember they show him going to talk to Odin Kincannon and stuff. So I think
that's right.
I think we do see him, but I don't remember those scenes vividly for sure.
I'm assuming that whenever they come across the Langells. That we will get some of those John Custer flashbacks.
I would assume so as well.
On the series. Yeah, this actor is definitely familiar to me. What is his freaking name? What is this guy's name? Is this character's name Mike? Mm-hmm. I'm about to find out. Mm. Oh, damn it. That's a list of actual comic book characters because it just showed Skeeter.
What about Billy Bob?
Billy Bob. He's going to marry his sister. It's good stuff.
Listen here, if anyone's going to have sex with my sister, it's going to be me.
Be me.
I left out the key word there, thankfully.
Thank you. I'm very glad you did, Nick, because we would have deleted that and had to restart the episode.
Yes, that's true.
I wonder if Billy Bob's on the show. Man.
I hope so at some point. Maybe a flashback. Although I have to imagine that would be considered to be pushing the bounds of good taste, would it not?
Perhaps. Perhaps you're correct. However, I am to understand that Adolf Hitler becomes a recurring character at some point.
That's true.
On this show. So.
That's accurate. I remember that. Ah, good stuff.
In any event, oh my God, there was actually a talking preacher after show at one point, hosted by Chris Hardwick.
I think one episode, or maybe they did one episode per season, or two. I think maybe they did season premiere and season finale, the first two seasons. I don't think they did it for season three.
What are some of the things that you liked seeing in this episode versus what we got for the majority of the first season?
A story that is familiar from the comics. It does not feel like they were stretching out. Because remember, that whole first season takes place in the span of what is essentially in the book, like, what, 15 pages?
Yep.
I mean, it is... You know I'm a fan of decompression, but the decompression in season one is a bit ridiculous. But, So pacing.
It was a Tom King on Batman level of decompression.
Oh, there that is. So it's the pacing, the familiarity, the improved character dynamics, the improved character interplay, I would say, and just, you know, just a genuinely more interesting story. Everything from top to bottom, even in this one episode, I'm already more invested than I recall being invested in anything in season one. So pretty much everything is better here. I'm struggling to think of something that isn't.
Right, I agree. I agree. The visuals are great. It feels like the there's more going on. There's right. more action. Even though we have a lot of dialogue, even though it's a lot of people sitting around talking, there's also stuff happening. There's progression towards the goal here, and there's just over the top action on top of it. We get to see also a little bit of some hints of things that fans of the that kind of nods to the comic, that people, while it's not a direct adaptation, nods enough to the comic that get people who have read the comic to go, oh, so they are going to go there. Sort of like the scene where they're sitting in the car and Cassidy is crushing on Tulip.
Mm-hmm.
And you see him kind of those feelings. I know they had sex in season one, but he has... You can see that it's more than just sex for him, that he actually has feelings for her, which is a huge, huge plot in the subplot in the comic that changes the dynamics of the whole team at a certain point. So you have to imagine that will come up later on as well. And also, Nick, I know we were talking over lunch today. You talked about your favorite Cassidy moment in the episode.
Oh, yeah. It took me a minute to even remember what you were talking about. But, yeah, so they wind up sharing a bed here, the three of them, one bedroom at this dude's house. And the three of them are lying in bed with Jesse stuck in the middle between Cassidy and Tulip. And Cassidy starts monologuing about how he knows the two of them probably have some long built-up sexual tension they need to release, and that back in Ireland, you know, you'd have a small little house and 6-7 kids running around, so your parents, whenever the need would strike them, would just start going at it right next to you all the time. And you'd see things, you'd hear things, you'd smell things. He wouldn't mind at all. He'd just nod off and let them do what they needed to do.
And then I would be loathe if I let this episode pass without mentioning the tremendous cliffhanger at the end of this episode. I mean, I have seen some good cliffhangers even recently in comic book television, but this is a doozy, man. This was such an effective cliffhanger that I actually went ahead and watched the second episode because I had to find out how they got out of this. So the end of this episode is Jesse kind of, you know, he's very confident, even to the verge of cockiness about the Saint of Killers. He said, if this guy shows up again, I'll handle it. And to this point in the episode, he's not even sure who the Saint of Killers is or who he's after, 100%. But, like, at the end of this episode, Jesse goes outside and he sees in the distance this figure marching towards him, and it's the Saint. And he uses Genesis, the voice inside of him, to command, which has the ability to command people to do whatever he wants them to do. And he commands this guy to stop, and he keeps walking. And he says it again. He says, stop! And he keeps walking. Genesis doesn't work on the Saint of Killers. And the Saint of Killers walks right up to Jesse, and he pulls his gun, and the episode ends with the Saint cocking his gun as he points it at Jesse. And he's dead on with him. So it's like, how is Jesse going to survive this when we know for a fact the Saint of Killers is unstoppable?
He's probably going to, at some point, hop back on season two and try to catch up here.
Indeed so. Indeed so. Well, with that being said, I mean, I can't really think of too much else to say. I don't want to belabor our points here. We've already kind of run out of things to say, but it was a very good episode. Promising episode for things to come. Preacher is a comic book that means a lot to a lot of people, including us. We're huge fans of the book by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. And I feel like whereas season one was more good than bad, but not necessarily at all times feeling like an adequate adaptation, season two is off on the right foot and makes me believe that it'll be worth my time to watch the rest of this season play out and the future seasons.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Well, we would love to get your thoughts on Preacher, the TV series. Let us know how you feel about it. If you're a fan of the book in particular, I'm interested to know your thoughts on the show. Shoot us a line on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. You can join the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page and leave us your comments there. You can send us emails, gregp@placetobenation.com, nickd@placetobenation.com. Send us a smoke signal. Nick has a telegraph machine you can contact. We'll be happy to give you that information off air. And with all that being said, we're going to take a break here in just a... Oh my God, this is the earliest we've ever had this happen on our show, Nick. My God, what's going on here?
I don't know. Why don't you tell us?
I'm going to find out. I'm going to find out right now. All right, let's see. What do we have? My God, Nick, this just in. Are you ready?
Yes.
Ho-Ho Loon's biographical information still available on the award-winning WWE Network.
Oh, outstanding. Outstanding, sir.
Man, this is good information. This is good, absolutely verified information. You can't beat it. I, for one, am happy that we're getting these updates again. This is great. The machine still works. Life is as it should be. Well, now we're going to take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we're going to have reading and watching. That's right. Both reading and watching this week. And we're going to have the rundown, the wrestling minute. We might even have a guest appearance. Who knows?
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. And we want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
We are back, live and in public, if you will. And, Nick, I don't know if you knew this, if you were aware of this, but it has been a busy time here at Place to Be Nation. We got a lot going on, something for everyone.
Oh, something for everyone, you say?
That's right. You know, right here at Place to Be Nation Pop, the feed that you're currently listening to right now, we've got a litany of content. We've got us, the hard-traveling fanboys. Because we had just last week a very well-reviewed episode of Countdown where we talked about the best rogues galleries in comics. Getting some good buzz on that one, Nick.
We are. I'm surprised by the response to it.
Yes, it has been both positive and productive. I don't know how it's been productive, actually. It's really just been positive. Let's move on from that.
Todd Weber. It's birthed the Fantastic Four truthers. We are out there and we are real.
And you're every bit as irrelevant as the Archie truthers.
Oh.
Todd Weber brings back Weber Has Issues in a new pod blast talking about three new Marvel books and how accessible they are to comic book fans. This time around, it's Marvel's Epilogue by Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross, History of the Marvel Universe Number 1 from Mark Waid and Javier Rodriguez, and the much-hyped House of X number 1 by Jonathan Hickman and Pepe Larraz. Mm-hmm. Jenny and Tim flipped the script in this edition of Talkin' Pop by welcoming multi-show host and multi-talented Andy Atherton for a journey that touches on Andy's ventures as a podcaster, producer, screenwriter, bartender, DJ, and choreographer. Pop Goes the Movies, when Andy and Jay Arsenio D'Amato get together to discuss the latest summer movie releases, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And that's not multiple releases. That's just one. I said that wrong. In a spoiler-filled review, I have seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Nick, have you?
Yes, I have.
What did you make of it?
I liked it. I liked it a great deal.
Did you like it a lot?
I did.
Yeah, I did too. I thought it was very good. On a new Sunday Groove, David Sunday talks his current favorite songs, the new movie Yesterday, and the Beatles. Actually, this hasn't been updated yet, but he just dropped a brand new Sunday Groove today as we record, where he's got Andy Helene joining him to talk about Desert Island albums. These are the albums that they would take with them if they were stranded on a deserted island for 5 years before coming back to become someone else, become something else.
I can't imagine David Sunday on a deserted island.
You don't think that he would find a way to become a vigilante when he returned home?
No. No, I do not.
No. Fair enough. We all have our opinions. JT joins Andy to talk about Kevin Smith's Dogma in the latest and greatest episode of Laugh In Theater. Now, Nick, first of all, I take offense to it being the greatest episode. I was on an episode once. Second of all, Dogma is a movie that has been watched and enjoyed by you. Yes.
Yeah, I love Dogma. One of my favorite Kevin Smith films.
I've told you my take on Dogma, right?
I think you liked it.
Yes. In fact, it's my favorite Kevin Smith movie,
which is surprising somewhat.
I can understand that, but I find it to be his funniest movie, his most poignant movie at times. Alongside a movie that you mock me for liking, which is Jersey Girl, and
that's funny because I think one of his most poignant movies is Clerks 2, a movie you mock me for liking.
Oh, so true, yes, that's correct. I own my hatred of Clerks 2. DC4U is back with the first week of Justice League. I think this is updated. It's first week of. Close enough to the first week of August. First week of
Justice League. It's not our responsibility to know what all's going on. Just read the thing.
Russell and Todd discuss the JLA's greatest stories, adapted media, and creators only on the DC. That's right, I remember it now. And only on the DC4U podcast. I was getting stuck in Superman month still. They also discuss the divisive Snyder Cut, whether it exists, whether it should exist. Pros, cons, etc. It's all about Justice League this month on our sister show, DC4U. Check it out, folks. Russell and Todd. The greatest song of the 80s tournament continues. There will be 6 polls a day posted for round 2. You can get in on the action on Facebook by searching PTBN's greatest song of the 80s tournament and liking the page. Be sure to weigh in. That's really not the only way you can join in, folks. You can also join in through Twitter. I'll go to the Place to Be Nation Twitter account and vote early and vote often, I say. Now, do you have any favorites now in the tournament, Nick, that you think are going to go all the way?
I don't. It seems like Michael Jackson songs. All the Michael Jackson songs are going to move on. It's going to be an all Michael Jackson and Prince Elite Eight is what it looks like right now.
That is certainly the way it's trending at the moment. I would certainly suggest that. Everybody knows it should be an all Ronnie Millsap final, but
yep.
Fortunately,
Oak Ridge Boys thrown in there, but no.
Yeah, there ain't no getting over me. Get the Oak Ridge Boys. I see you trying to squeeze that past me. No.
Oak Ridge Boys.
My baby is American made. What a stupid song.
Born and bred in the USA.
A Sony Clear TV.
There it is.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
The Oak Ridge Boys.
Oak Ridge Boys. No, we can't have any country songs in the tournament. If they are, it's like 9 to 5 by Dolly Parton, which I'm going
to
say.
9 to 5.
I'm going to say it is not a very good song.
Yep. Thank you.
Not to mention the fact it got matched up against, like, I don't even remember what it got matched up. I want to say like Sweet Child of Mine or something stupid like that, where it had no chance of winning. So I'm pretty sure all the country songs are eliminated by now. All three of the, you know, out of the 256 songs or whatever it was, they picked 3 that they thought.
Oh, it was more than that.
I don't know. I honestly don't know. I haven't paid attention. You know, paid attention.
But listen, this anti-country bias is going to have to be addressed. Maybe, Nick, we need to do our own tournament.
Our own tournament. Or just you and I, Greg.
Oh, yeah. Tell me more.
SummerSlam 2019 is in the books, and we have a pair of instant recap shows for you. On Chain Reaction, Nate, Scott, Jenny, and Brent broke down the weekend's events, and on the monthly PPV Reaction Show, Chris and Devon dive in and give their thoughts on SummerSlam. Talking WCW is back with Greg, Tim, and Jenny dissecting a trifecta of matches featuring Rey Mysterio. Greg, how was that?
It was great.
Outstanding. In a new wrestling war zone, Chad and JT look into a memorable night of wrestling TV by examining the January 90s Raw and Nitro. On Main Event, Scott, Steve, and Nate talk SummerSlam, and also were joined by Pete Schumacher and Ben Zani to recap this year's Scenic City Invitational. Ben and Pete also broke down the full 2019 SCI weekend on Row 1, Seat 1. Fascinating. On Episode 2 of Extreme Three-Way Dance, JT, D'Amato, and Jenny take a look at February 1994's The Night the Line Was Crossed. And on Episode 7...
Why can you never get through this?
It's just such a great name for a podcast. It's a good name. It's a funny name. I think they named it that on purpose to elicit a chuckle from people. It makes me laugh. On Episode 7 of You Don't Know Billy Jack, Drew introduces Jordan to Saruta versus Tenryu from 6589. Why is You Don't Know Billy Jack not an entire podcast about Billy Jack?
About Billy Jack Haynes? I don't know. I was wondering the same thing. I want to get to know more about Billy Jack
the
Haynes.
The Oregon Duck.
He really killed those boys on that state track.
On PlaceToBeNation.com, BTBN's tribute to 1994 continues to roll on with lots of great content. Also, the Draft Wars crew was back with a draft of SummerSlam matches. Read the recap and cast your vote on who had the best draft. Glenn's Weekly Walk, I've mentioned it. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE, PPV, and TV Match Ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Speaking of researching, Nick, you tried to blow right past my dissection of Rey Mysterio's matches from WCW, but in fact, it's quite good, and I would recommend everyone to go listen to that episode for some fascinating insight, including a guest appearance from none other than K-Dog himself, the legendary Conan, as he explains to us how Rey Mysterio, how Psicosis attempted to give Rey Mysterio a Splash Mountain off the top rope, but he reversed it into a Frankensteiner. It's really fascinating stuff.
Sounds fascinating. All right.
So, with that being said, we are going to move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comics. It's a segment known the world over, particularly in New Zealand, as The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
A little bit of a light week this week, Nick, in the old Rundown.
Thank God. We've had what feels like a never-ending slew of just a deluge of news, so it's nice to have a little bit of a slower weekend.
Now, I've heard on Twitter that you're not a big fan of the never-ending slew.
Are you talking about the never-ending story?
I'm just saying, never-ending slew, never-ending story.
The never-ending story from the 1980s, the film, is an overrated piece of garbage.
In your opinion?
In my opinion, yes. Do you have strong feelings about the never-ending story?
I'll be completely honest with you. I'm not entirely sure I've ever seen it. I don't remember what it's about. What's the premise?
Oh, it's some fantasy movie with a kid. I can't remember. Some kid gets into this.
Oh, if it had a kid in it, I probably didn't like it.
There was a big giant white dog that flew, and he rode the white dog.
Don't you remember, Nick? I don't like movies with kids in them.
That's true.
The
Never-Ending Story is an English-language German fantasy film directed and co-written by Wolfgang Petersen.
Oh, what a great name. I love me some Wolfgang Petersen.
Hey, Bastian Balthazar Bux is a shy and outcast bibliophile 10-year-old raised by his widowed father, teased by bullies from school. On his way to school, he hides from the bullies in a bookstore, interrupting the grumpy bookseller. He asks about one of the books he sees called The Neverending Story, but he advises against it. Anyway, the book takes him to a different world, and he has to learn how to save the world, and he rides a big white dog, and it's all boring as hell.
You would think that if it takes him to a different world, you'd think it would have taken him to The Cosby Show first.
Mm. Take a look. It's in a book. Reading Rainbow.
Reading Rainbow. Hey, you know who's not reading a lot of things, apparently?
Us.
Us and other digital comics readers.
Oh, did we do the rundown jingle already?
We already did the rundown jingle.
Okay.
DC co-publisher and chief creative officer, not office as it says here in this article on a major news site, which I will not name, Newsarama.
Editing doesn't matter anymore, Greg. Don't you know that by now?
Jim Lee has opened up about the state of DC's digital comics offerings, mm-hmm. including the publisher's DC Universe streaming service. So there's a positive story here and a negative story. Nick, what do you want to tackle first?
The negative story, because then that'll lead naturally into the positive story.
If it bleeds, it leads, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bad news is DC's individual digital comic sales are not doing well. In fact, and Jim Lee has said it himself that the digital sales have, quote, hit a wall. He says, here's his direct quote, "I think it's been pretty flat in recent years, which is a little disheartening. A lot is moving to subscription, and that is having a downward pressure on transactional sales. But I think it's discouraging in general because everyone talks about digital being the future. If there's anything that should continue to grow year in and year out, it should be that channel. The fact that it's kind of plateaued and we've hit a wall speaks to a lot of different things."
I have so many issues with that statement.
Tell me more.
He says everything is moving to subscription. Then he says that digital should be growing year over year, despite the fact that what he is saying is that he believes that individual digital sales of comic books priced at $4 should be growing every single year, while also people move to a subscription model where you pay $10 a month and get to read all the comics you want. So $4 for a single comic book or $10 for thousands of comic books? Like, basic fucking economics here. I mean, and not to mention, I think it was Stephanie, our good friend Stephanie on Twitter, who brought up a good point, especially in the case of something like the Batman Damned controversy, which happened last year. If they are going to charge the same amount of money for a digital copy as they charge for a physical copy, I'll just go buy the physical copy because then I know it will never be taken can't be taken away from me. It's not like I'm having to rely on a service, and it can't be censored after the fact. Like,
yep.
It is as it was intended to be originally. So if you're not going to incentivize me financially to buy the digital version, then why would I? Like, I've said many times, I think
you're preaching to the choir on this.
I think digital is the future, still, absolutely. But digital via the subscription model is the future. Everything is going to the subscription model, whether it be sports television, whether it be movies, whether it be, I mean, every specialized form of entertainment is going to an over-the-top subscription model. DC is years behind Marvel in adopting that model, and now they're surprised that people don't want to pay $4 or $5 for a single comic book when they can get all the comics for $10? No fucking... Like, why is this a revelation to Jim Lee? Jim Lee seems like a smart guy.
Well, here I think is... I hear everything you say, and I agree with everything you say. I've said for years, why would I want to pay $4 for a digital comic when I don't even like reading digital comics, to be honest. I like reading physical comics, but I've grown to get used to it due to the subscription services, which are so great a value. I think there are concerns that I still have never gotten adequate answers on. Even our good friend Ben Morris has not necessarily been able to ascertain the answers on this, but if we both believe that the subscription model is going to end up even further eroding the traditional comics fan base, let's extrapolate that to what its natural conclusion is. Maybe you still have printed graphic novels. Maybe you still have occasional printed single comics. But if it continues over the course of a decade or so, maybe let's just imagine a scenario in which the majority of comic book readers are getting their content through subscription service. Mm-hmm. What then happens to profits of the company? Do all of those fans of the physical comics translate over to the subscription comics? Because we've seen that that hasn't happened with something like wrestling. We know for a fact that there are not as many people subscribed to the WWE Network as there are that watch WWE. So,
well, that's not really the equivalency you're trying to draw in that particular scenario, though. You're comparing it to all pay-per-view buys. I mean, that's the most direct comparison.
Right.
And
you know, roughly around that point. So,
and they're well past that because they're right around the 1 million subscriber mark, which they rarely, if ever, hit 1 million pay-per-view buys, especially not for a non-WrestleMania event.
But the other point of this is wrestling is a little bit easier to pay people based on, okay, if you're not – even if you don't have a pay-per-view where people are actually paying money to see that specific event, mm-hmm. you do have to pay money to attend the event, which then can go into a coffer that can then be paid out to the talent, however your system works out. Comic books, you have your writers and your artists, your letterers, your colorers, your editors. There's a lot of people involved in producing a comic book. I look at it akin to producing a television show or a movie. Making a movie, they get ticket sales at the box office. They get DVD sales, stuff like that. How is the money distribution thing going to work with creators and comics moving forward? Because, for instance, if you're the artist on the top-selling comic book in the world right now, let's say you're the artist on Batman, I'm assuming you get a cut of those sales, and that's how they justify paying Scott Snyder more money than they would pay whoever is writing what's a low-selling book, Nick, I don't know, Amethyst. Now what happens in this fictitious future we've created where everything's subscription, I'm paying $12 a month, let's just say, to read every Marvel comic book that's ever been published. Mm-hmm. How is Marvel making money on this long term? B, making enough money to pay the men and women who are actually making these comics? And if they cannot afford to pay these men and women what they once were able to pay these men and women, are these men and women even going into comics? Or are they going into animation or at a big studio somewhere where they can make a lot of money on their own? I don't know. I think there are a lot of issues regarding talent pay that right now Marvel Unlimited and the DC Universe app, while they're gaining in popularity, are still niche. There will become a point where they're no longer niche. They are the norm. I think we both know that that's where we're going with all this. So my question for you, Nick, or not really for you, but for whoever can answer it, is how are they going to distribute the money in a way that is seen as equitable and rewarding to the men and women who are creating these characters for DC and Marvel?
I mean, I don't really know the answer to that, but you know, one of the things is that if you went to this hypothetical all-digital future, you're cutting down on the physical cost of printing the comic. You no longer have to distribute the comic. So there are various, you know, you're going to save a lot of money, and in theory, you should be able to sell a $100,000, a $13 subscription to more people than, I mean, the highest-selling book in comics right now sells, what, around 100,000 copies a month?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so to use your comparison,
but are those 130,000 unique buyers of Batman that also don't buy? Are they not? Is there a totally separate pool of people that are the 130,000 buying Batman and the 90,000 buying Spider-Man or whatever?
What I'm saying is, I think to use your comparison from earlier, something like Amethyst, which is probably selling like in the neighborhood of like 15,000, that's an additional 85,000 people that are now exposed to that comic that would not have been exposed to it otherwise because they weren't going to buy it. So, I mean, there's always some give and pull with that. I don't know what the financial structure for that is, much like we don't know the financial structure for how wrestlers are paid. That's just something that's always been a mystery to us. And so, me personally,
We also know that there are more streams of income for WWE than there are for Marvel Comics as a division.
Yes, but you have to remember, in this case, in a lot of instances, unless they're signed to exclusive deals, which I would imagine come with some sort of downside guarantee, comics creators are truly, genuinely independent contractors. They can go and create something for Image and do that while also writing for Marvel or DC, and there is nothing to prevent them from doing so. This topic of
My point of long term, though, I think that still creates a concern of maybe we lose all of our top flight creators will say, I'm going to go and write and create things for DC and Marvel that they're going to own, and they're not going to pay me like what they were going to pay me a decade ago. Hell no, I'm just going to do my own thing.
Well, that arguably is already happening. Like, that's not a new issue.
Oh, sure.
I mean, like,
no, it's not new, but I'm saying that this right now, indisputably, that's a way that they can justify charging these ridiculous amounts that they charge for these comics is, well, we need that money to pay our writers and artists
in a manner. Much of that do you think is actually going to the writer or the artist?
Oh, not enough, absolutely.
So no, that argument rings a bit hollow for me.
I think that there are legitimate questions to the streaming server. Now, as a fan, and I think the problem is we as fans get wrapped up in what's good for me as a fan. And I totally agree. For me as a fan, I would much rather have access to every comic known to man. And I've been saying for years, not just me, people way smarter than me, have been saying for years that comic books are overpriced. However, I do think that there is a domino effect. And it's not, and you're right, it's nothing new. It's been happening for many years. But I think that there is a domino effect here that is worth considering. Now, should we get to the positive news aspect of this?
Sure.
The positive news aspect of this is that DC Universe is, according to Jim Lee, the future of the publisher, with subscriptions remaining active and outpacing individual digital comic book sales.
What a shock.
Lee says that there's always going to be room for a tool that allows us to engage directly with fans. We have nothing really like it. So we're creating something that is a place for all DC fans to come together, buy, read, enjoy, connect, and communicate with or share the community with one another. It's vital and important, and we are going to have original content going forward, but they're still building their back catalog. So this is the future, Nick. This service is the future. We've seen it with Marvel Unlimited. We're seeing it now with DC Universe, that regardless of what happens with the television and movies portion of DC Universe, the comic book side continues to grow, and they are just as committed as Marvel is to it. And you wonder if in the future we might even see those delay windows shrinking. What do you think?
I think that absolutely makes a lot of sense. That's the one area where DC is kind of still behind Marvel. They've got them beat on price. If they continue to upload at the pace that they are, they're going to have them beat on sheer volume of catalogs because they have that additional, 30 years or whatever it is, 28 years or whatever the number is, of comics to print, Golden Age stuff that they can utilize. And really the only area where they're lagging now is Marvel has a 6-month window, DC has a 1-year window. Do you think that the additional 6-month window is really going to boost your graphic novel sales, your physical sales that much? Maybe they do. I don't know what the numbers are on that, but I know Marvel doesn't seem to be hurting in terms of their graphic novel sales, and Marvel Unlimited is still a thing, so I don't see any reason why you can't have both.
Well, one thing that we can't have both of is the legendary creative team of Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Capullo just tweeted out the other day, Nick, that he has signed a brand new contract with DC Comics and is once again teaming with Scott Snyder to produce, wait for it, their biggest adventure yet.
Mm.
Now, Nick, every adventure they go on seems to be bigger than the previous adventure they've gone on, mm-hmm. which seems to create a Dragon Ball Z-like effect here.
How does Turnbull play into all of this if we're talking about Dragon Balls?
Well, Turnbull's going to grow out his hair a little bit longer for this one, and then contemplate on it a little bit.
Yes.
And probably fire old cannonballs around. But, so in all seriousness, Capullo and Snyder are a dynamite team together, responsible for one of the great Batman runs in history. What do you think this next project could be?
Honestly, I think it's a Metal sequel.
Yeah, probably. We're never gonna be rid of the Batman Who Laughs.
I mean, and honestly, I have not read Scott Snyder's Justice League. I don't know what it is, but the reviews I've read make it sound like a thing that flows very much from the same, is cut from the same cloth as Metal. And if that's the case, this current era of Scott Snyder is probably just not an era of his career that I'm overly invested in. And so if we're going to get more stories in that vein, then I think I'll just skip it. Thanks.
What would be your ideal here? What would you like to see this announcement be in a dream world?
They've teased different things. I know our good friend Russell has said that they've talked about a Wonder Woman run. That might be pretty cool and could be a nice little middle ground between the grounded nature of his Batman run with the more fantastical stuff that he's introduced in Metal. Maybe a Green Lantern run. That would be cool. But we have to pry it out of Grant Morrison's god-awful hands first. I don't know. I'm sure there'll be more Batman projects, even though he said that was his last one. I doubt it. I assume they'll reteam for something. Or maybe he just comes on to do help out with the Justice League run. I mean, there are any number of things they could do.
I know it's not going to be this, because this wouldn't qualify as biggest or big. I tell you what I would want him to do, what I would want this particular team to do in my dream world. Can you guess, Nick?
Question?
Nope.
Nightwing?
Yep.
Featuring Rick Grayson?
Why do you feel the need to bring up Rick Grayson? Rick Grayson.
If he's going to do a Nightwing run, I'm assuming Rick Grayson would have to play a role that is the character, is it not?
No, it's not the character. If he takes it over, Dick Grayson would be the character, because Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo would likely ignore all the stupid bullcrap that Tom King and his cronies have inflicted upon Dick Grayson.
Because Danny D wanted it.
Danny D can suck it. Anyway, Scott Snyder, I've said this before, Under the Radar is probably my favorite Dick Grayson writer, and I would love to see him get a full proper run writing just Dick Grayson as Nightwing, and Capullo drawing it would be out of this world. So I'll talk more about them a little bit later in the show, Nick. How about that?
How about that?
How about Marvel Television, by the way?
How about them?
Marvel Television and Hulu have rebranded the banner of their upcoming Ghost and Sweet Jesus. What the hell is that? Have rebranded the banner of their upcoming Ghost Rider and Hellstrom shows. Nick, are you excited?
Yes, and we'll move on.
The line of Supernatural Marvel shows was announced as Spirits of Vengeance, but now will be organized under the much stupider name Adventure into Fear.
I think that's the name of one of the old anthology books, but
it may be, Nick, but Spirits of Vengeance sounds awesome. Sounds cool.
Spirits of Vengeance is also like specifically tied to Ghost Rider. I think they wanted something a bit more general.
It is. And Adventure into Fear isn't bad in and of itself, but when I say stupider, I just mean a comparison. Spirits of Vengeance sounds badass. Adventure into Fear sounds like some show starring a kid in the mid-90s on Nickelodeon. We're going to adventure into fear with ghost stories.
You hate kids.
I don't hate kids. Love your kids.
But you hate
I like your kids more than you like your kids.
That's not true. You hate kids that go on adventures, though. You hate kids that walk and do things.
I hate kids on television. I hate television kids that do things.
Greg, tell us all your thoughts on this new film that's coming out, Good Boys.
I think it looks terrible and stupid and is completely uninteresting. And I'm not interested in a bunch of kids cussing. I don't find it funny. Because that's the whole joke, is that they're cussing. There's no, if they're telling jokes and cussing, that's fine. But there's no joke. It's just them cussing. And even worse, a little girl talking about sex stuff. Come on now. Who's younger than them? Ridiculous. I don't like it. I'm not going to watch it. But to those who do, more power to you.
Thank you.
Did I give you what you wanted?
Yes.
All right.
You always do.
Oh, that's nice of you, Nick. That's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
It was meant to be a sexual euphemism, but we'll move on.
Oh. Well, still, I'll take the compliment.
Why, thank you. I try.
Oh.
I am a very generous lover.
Unfortunately, Disney is not being generous with Fox's two mutants.
God, the transitions. Continue.
Pretty good, wasn't it?
I guess so.
Hey, I'd be generous to that Taylor. What's her fucking name?
Taylor
Anna something.
Anya Taylor Joy.
That person, yeah, the one from Split, yeah.
Oh yeah, she is in this movie, is she not?
Yeah, she plays magic.
Well, she's supposed to be in this movie that I'm not entirely sure we're ever actually going to see.
Yeah, Disney is not being generous with the movie-going community because apparently, according to Variety now, Disney is unhappy with the overall box office performance of Fox-produced films this year, including Dark Phoenix, of course. And that may spell trouble for New Mutants. The Hollywood Trade reports other reports suggesting that Disney is unimpressed with New Mutants, believing it has limited box office potential. Now, for a long time, there's been rumors that it would be released on a streaming service like Hulu instead of the box office. However, at last update, it had been greenlit for reshoots with a new 2020 release date scheduled. Now scheduled for April 3, 2020. Funny. Okay, I'm sorry. I know you're Mr. Disney, Nick. I know you're Mr. Disney can do no wrong.
Oh, God, here we go.
Just fucking put the movie out on Hulu. Like, why are they even still, if they don't think it has box office potential, just put it up on streaming. But at least people should have a chance to see the movie and judge for themselves.
I'm sorry, did this report indicate anywhere that they were not going to release the movie?
The report indicates that they are going to do reshoots and put the movie out on a new theatrical date of April of 2020.
Which was the one that was announced previously several weeks ago when we discussed the story last.
Yes. So,
and reshoots, my understanding is that reshoots were the plan prior to acquisition, that Fox was planning on reshooting and then drug their feet on it.
Sure.
So what exactly, my question here as Mr. Anti-Disney to you is, what exactly does Disney have to do with this?
Disney owns the movie now.
They do own the movie now.
They can either shit or get off the pot. So if they don't think it has box office potential, get off the pot and just release it on Hulu.
Or what if they do
the reshoots? Sit on the project.
What if they do the reshoots and then release it anyway?
What if they? I mean, are they going to do that, Nick? Do you have any indication they're going to do that?
Have any indication they're not? We don't know. Is the answer?
This article indicates that they're probably not going to do that because they don't think it has box office potential. Oh. They don't think it can make money. Why would they release a movie they don't think can make money?
I think it will be released in some form or fashion somewhere, whether that is theatrical or not.
Hopefully, I'm just saying these actors are going to be in their 40s by the time they get to see themselves as kids on the screen.
Well. It'll eliminate any concerns about the age of Anya Taylor-Joy.
Hey! There we go. There we go. Ah, Lord.
Disney is our new benevolent overlord, Greg, and I think we should all thank them for their generosity.
I don't know what they are. We'll see going forward.
It's like you sound like that pretentious film critic I saw earlier complaining about Disney.
Pretentious film critic. You're talking about A.O. What's-his-face?
No,
the guy that said Dark Knight was... What did he say? I don't know. He said that thing about that. That was I can't remember.
Somebody... He was quoting, I think, a similar piece that came out about how Disney wasn't sure about that Jojo Rabbit movie. And this guy, William Bibbiani, said, "Ha ha 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 ha, they're buying up everything and throttling the art form in front of our eyes, and yet people are celebrating the streets because Wolverine can finally fight a raccoon or whatever, and this all sucks, every single part of it." And I almost responded, wait, Wolverine's going to fight a raccoon? That sounds awesome. But I decided not to.
It does sound awesome. But I also think there are legit concerns there.
You people are aware that Fox was going to sell the studio to a larger conglomerate regardless, right?
Certainly. Certainly.
Like, we are also, it was Comcast or it was Disney. So, which, I mean, do you want to shit in your left hand or shit in your right hand here, knowing you have to shit somewhere?
At least it would not. It would be a separate company having creative rights over stuff than one company having creative rights over seemingly everything. But
it just feels that way because you and I are into geek culture. It's not that way for everything.
Well, another thing that I wanted to discuss, Nick, is a second helping of the Tales of the Dark Multiverse 48-page one-shots that are coming in November. These are the stories we talked about recently on the show that are reimagining the classic DC events from over time. And the next batch to be coming out will be reimagining two stories that are pretty close to our Geoff Johns loving hearts, Nick. Infinite Crisis and Blackest Night. The first one will be Tales from the Dark Multiverse, Blackest Night, number one. And it's described as the following. This sounds pretty intriguing to me. Writer Tim Seeley and artist Kyle Hotz are on this. And they retell the tale of the Green Lantern event that changed the DC Universe forever, only this time the Black Lanterns emerge triumphant. It's 23 days after the cataclysm. Sinestro, trapped between life and death as a white and a black lantern, emerges as the world's last hope, the Limbo Lantern. Don't love that name. Mm-mm. In order to save the universe or end his life, he'll need the help of some unlikely survivors, Dove, Lobo, and Mr. Miracle, all of whom will put their lives on the line to give the world one final chance. Other than that name, the Limbo Lantern, that sounds awesome, Nick. What do you think?
Yeah, this one sounds cool. I'm into this. I'm always into anything that puts Sinestro front and center. Yep. The other one, however, while I love Infinite Crisis, the original story, I got to admit, this Infinite Crisis premise does not set my world on fire.
Writer James Tynion IV and artists Aaron Lopresti and Matt Ryan. Why are there so many Matt Ryans, Nick?
It's a simple name, common name.
Team up with cover artist Lee Weeks for a dark turn on DC's mega event Infinite Crisis. The destruction of Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, the rise of Alexander Luthor and Superboy Prime, and the rebirth of the multiverse all began with Ted Kord, the Blue Beetle. Kord saw it coming and died with secrets that could have saved the world. But in the dark multiverse, Blue Beetle survives, and with the death of Maxwell Lord by his hand, Ted sets off events that irreversibly alter the lives of not only the Justice League, but also his best friend, Booster Gold. In trying to prevent a crisis, Blue Beetle becomes the crisis, and the dark multiverse will never be the same. Sounds a little bit like Armageddon 2001 in that regard. It shares some commonalities in that. This line continues to put out some interesting ideas, Nick. What do you think?
Yeah, like I said, into Blackest Night, not so much into the Infinite Crisis one.
In other news, Marvel and Stitcher are teaming up for a new fictional podcast series, as opposed to a non-fictional podcast series, I guess. Marvels, launching in fall 2019. The 10-episode series will be available exclusively on Stitcher Premium until 2020. More details after I click this link. Method Man's involved. He's going to be in it, playing Ben Urich. That'll be cool.
Method Man's playing Ben Urich? That's awesome.
Yep. In 2020, it will then see a wide release across all podcast platforms.
Yep. Same release schedule as the Wolverine podcasts that have been out, where they I think they're exclusive to Stitcher Premium for 6 months and then go to general free, you know, ad-supported free podcasts after that six-month release window.
Mm-hmm. The series is part of a celebration marking the 25th anniversary of Kurt Busiek and Alex Ross's award-winning four-part comic book Marvels, which was released to critical acclaim in 1994. And this will feature Method Man as Ben Urich, Anna Sophia Robb as Marcia Hardesty, Ethan Peck as Mr. Fantastic, and Seth Barish as Phil Sheldon. So they are building on the momentum of Wolverine the Longest Night and Wolverine the Lost trail with this. I know you were a fan of that Wolverine podcast, at least what you listened to of it, Nick. So what are your thoughts on this?
I like that first season of the Wolverine podcast very much. I haven't listened to the second season yet. So this is cool. And this one is, rather than doing an original story, is adapting a story that is beloved by many and one that I think we should probably read at some point here for the podcast, but we'll get there at some point. So yeah, always looking for more audio content to fill out my work day, and this will be another drop in that bucket.
Another drop in the bucket indeed. And with that, we come to the end of another edition of The Rundown. Can you believe it, Nick? Feels like just yesterday that we started it.
Just yesterday. That's right.
Well, with that being said, it is time to get to our segment that we haven't done in a few weeks now, Nick. A segment that dates back to the beginning of our show. A segment called Reading and Watching. Well, Nick, what you been reading?
Nothing.
Well, believe it or not, I've got a shock for the audience today. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I have read an entire American comic book.
Excellent. Excellent.
Published in the year 2019.
Tell me more.
I will. I have finished the first issue of the prestige format miniseries from DC's Black Label called Batman Last Night on Earth. I finished the first issue. It's by Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo, purportedly their final story involving Batman. And I talked about starting this story not too long ago on the show, and I finally got around to finishing it this past weekend. I'm on the hook. They got me on the hook. I'm going to see this to fruition and see how it concludes. It is very good, very good dialogue, and also very confusing at times. It's kind of, at times I feel like I'm in the labyrinth from the Court of Owls in terms of trying to keep up with where the narrative is taking me, and I'm still not entirely sure that everything is on the level, but it is a dystopian future that we're in that reveals that, without spoiling too much about this story, the machines that Bruce was working on in the Snyder and Capullo run, I don't know if you remember, that were designed to make sure that there would be a Batman for every generation of Gotham.
Yeah, the one that they eventually used to restore Bruce's memories or whatever, right?
Yep, that one. That machine ends up being utilized as sort of the linchpin of this story. It has unintended results, not necessarily unintended, but it is seen through to its completion, and it plays a factor in this story of where we end up with this mystery about what happened to the world. It's almost like a DC version of Old Man Logan in a way, but Bruce is not an old man. Mm-hmm. It's a world where the heroes lost. At some point, there was a conflict, and the heroes lost, and the world was lost, and the world was undone. And it seems also to tie into Scott Snyder's Justice League, because it ties into this concept of Lex Luthor convincing the world of the value of doom versus justice, and ultimately him being undone by that as well, and this new thing arising called Omega that appears to have taken the place of Darkseid. And the world is a wasteland, and only some heroes survive from the old days, and they've gone underground and are protecting the few 100,000 people who have still survived. So it's a pretty interesting concept. You've also got the Joker's head in a jar talking to Batman the whole time, but you're not entirely sure whether this is real or whether it's a figment of his imagination, as is the case with a lot of stuff in this issue. So I would say the best way I would classify this is bizarre at times, but fascinating at the same time. So they've got me on the hook. I'll see where it leads. Not my favorite Snyder and Capullo Batman story, but definitely compelling, and the artwork is amazing, as it always is. So I'm on the hook for this one. I'm going to see where it ends, and hopefully it starts to become clearer to me as it progresses. But I still enjoyed it.
Glad to hear you enjoyed it, and I'm glad that we were actually able to have a reading this week.
A very rare occurrence.
Oh! Now,
ooh.
One other thing. Playing.
Ah, you been playing anything, Nick?
I have beaten, on the easiest difficulty, Marvel Ultimate Alliance 3, finally.
Well, let's hear your thoughts on the game without spoiling anything for me.
The only thing, I enjoyed it very much. It's a good Thanos-focused story. I will say, as someone who hasn't read many modern Marvel events, I don't know what the fuck a Thane is or what it has to do with anything, so I was very lost by that. But that notwithstanding, the game itself is outstanding. I still have some characters that I need to unlock and some missions to complete and haven't 100%ed it quite entirely yet, so I'm probably going to play it for a little while longer, but the main story mode has been completed. Good game. Hope there's another one.
How would you rank it compared to the first two?
I would say ahead of the second one, and probably slightly. That first one, just, I don't know, something about it. Maybe it's the nostalgia talking. Maybe it's the perfect blend of gameplay and not being mind-numbingly difficult. And the story, I think, is a little better than the first one. So I'm still going to go. I would go 1-3-2 if I were ranking them.
I'm looking forward to playing it at some point in the future. And, you know, whenever they release it on PlayStation, or whenever I visit you again, mm-hmm. which, keep this up, will be never.
Keep what?
I don't know. You're just your general Reed Richards like attitude.
You mean my intelligent attitude? If it's Reed
Richards
like,
you're being convinced of being as intelligent or more intelligent than those around you, including geniuses like the Incredible Hulk or Bruce Banner and who's that other guy? Tony Stark, Iron Man,
Charles Xavier.
Who's that annoying kid that became the Hulk again?
Amadeus Cho. Yep. Riri Williams.
All of these people, and Reed Richards walks around like he's the cock of the walk.
Bruce baby.
Dickinson.
He is.
He put on his gold pants, record at a time. What you been watching, Nick? Comic book related.
Nothing.
Nothing. You mean me to believe that you haven't watched a single thing comic book related?
Other than Preacher, which we just talked about. They make a lot of X-Men references in Stranger Things Season 3, which I just finished.
What were your thoughts on Stranger Things Season 3?
Oh, it was awesome. I don't know. It's tricky, because I think Stranger Things is so well done that you might like it, but you can't get around the fact that it's built around kids going on adventures. So, I mean, it's a fine line to walk.
Do you know, I did like one kid that went on an adventure.
Who's that?
I liked when JB went on his adventure with the Sasquatch.
Yes.
That was pretty awesome.
They've been showing that on Fusion a lot lately, and I've been catching it.
Oh, what a movie. Mm-hmm. What a movie. That's a great movie. You already are. I still say they could have made a kids show out of that. They could have appealed to children with the Sasquatch character. They chose not to. What do I know? Anyway, no, I haven't been watching anything either. I should have finished Supergirl now, but I haven't yet.
Yeah, I got to finish Black Lightning. That's the big thing, because now that it's going to be involved in Crisis, I have to catch up before Crisis.
Have to catch up, yeah. Well, now that the G1's over, we'll have a little bit more time.
Time enough at last.
Yeah. So the G1 has finished, and we have a couple weeks before football for our teams kick up. So,
although some of us are dedicated fans who actually watch the NFL preseason.
I'd rather shit on my hand than watch that. That's a lie. And we want to do that. I don't know. The preseason just doesn't light my world on fire. It's all a bunch of guys that won't play long, and then I get excited about players that look good in the preseason, and the regular season starts, and they suck. You know how it is.
I do.
In any event, we're done with that. We have nothing more to say on that. And, you know, I can't help but look over to the right of me, Nick, at my giant wristwatch that I bought the other day. Mm-hmm. It's actually the size of what a wristwatch would be for a Sentinel from the X-Men. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool. And it's sitting there leaning on my wall, and it says on it that it's time for the wrestling minute.
Indeed.
My gosh, Nick, what a lot of activities continue to go on. We just had one of the more loaded wrestling weekends. Mm-hmm. G1 shows, NXT TakeOver, SummerSlam, Monday Night Raw, Tuesday Night SmackDown. I mean, just a litany of wrestling shows.
You mean SmackDown Live?
Whatever. Where do we start?
Oh, where would you like to start? I have not yet finished the G1, so I can't give in-depth on it.
You know, we're both far behind on the G1, but you, in the last week, Nick, you surpassed my G1 watching.
Mm-hmm, I did.
You, in 1 week's time, you overtook the man that had lapped you in G1 and now have surpassed me, and I haven't had a chance to catch up.
Yeah, I've got to watch all I have left is the final night from each block. So I've got night 17, night 18, and then the final to watch. So only 11 matches left in my G1 watching. And some of those I've heard are outstanding, so I'm really looking forward to it. I had considered waking up early to watch the final live, despite not being caught up. Then I read the results of the B block final and said, you know what? I think I'll just skip it. And so I'll watch it. I will watch it sometime this week, probably.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I feel the same way about the B block winner.
I don't get it. I mean.
People say we're wrong about that, but
some people do. A lot of people don't.
True. But yes, I did watch NXT TakeOver
from
Toronto, and another stellar show from the Yellow brand.
It was a really good show. I'll be honest. I don't think it was up to typical TakeOver par. I'll put it that way.
I'm kind of torn on that. I thought the tag team match tore the house down.
You have to understand that typical TakeOver par is like every single match on the damn card delivers. Like,
I mean, there's no getting around the Shayna and I've been interested to get your thoughts on this match because you're a huge Shayna Baszler fan. Mm-hmm. You're higher on Shayna, almost all of Shayna's matches than the consensus, even though most of her matches are really good. Mm-hmm. You've had those where you thought she had the best match of the night on
these different
takeovers.
That's the biggest thing is like these takeover matches are always real good, right?
Yeah.
But so the tag matches, and granted, tag matches are laid out differently than singles matches. I understand that they're different by the structure of them, but like the tag matches and the main events and even some of the mid-card matches are often structured in that like, oh my God, false finish, kick out, you know, that hyper. That almost wrestling on hyperspeed, which I'm not criticizing. I like that. I like that as a flavor. And the Shayna matches are not that. They almost feel out of place on every takeover card that they're on, and I think that's why I like them so much, is because every other match, because she's unique, and I think that's the biggest thing. She has a unique feel performing in ring, similar to a Brock Lesnar or something like that. Not to Brock's degree, and Brock certainly probably has more variety in his stuff, where Brock can work Rollins' match, or he can work Finn Balor's match, as we've seen him do. Everybody who has wrestled Shayna to this point is working Shayna's match, and that's fine. But again, it's different than everything else that NXT offers at this juncture, which is probably why I like it so much. So your question is, did I like the Shayna Baszler and Mia Yim match, I guess?
Yes.
I did like it. I didn't love it. I know a lot of people thought it was really bad. I didn't think it was bad, but I thought it was probably, or not probably, I thought it was the worst Shayna takeover match I've seen ever. Like, I'm trying to run down her list of takeover matches dating back to last, I guess her first one would have been what, the first Kyrie match would have been her first takeover match. Is that right?
Because
she lost to Kyrie and then beat her for the title to win the title. Right.
Right. Right. Right. Correct.
So yeah, this is the worst Shayna takeover match, but still, I enjoyed it.
And see, I thought it was a bad match.
Okay.
I would classify this as probably one of the worst takeover matches, actually.
Think about that. I don't know.
Kind of drags the show. It's certainly the worst to me in modern NXT era. Certainly in some of those early shows, you probably had some Bull Dempsey matches and stuff like that. That would have dragged things down.
And to me, while I still really enjoyed it and really enjoyed the main event, I think there's an argument to be made that this was the worst Johnny Gargano main event takeover match in a long time. I like both of the previous Cole matches better than this one. I like all of the Ciampa matches better than this one. I certainly like the Andrade match better than this one. Like, I'm struggling to think of the other Gargano takeover matches that have occurred between now and then. He had a mid-card one against Velveteen Dream, but I'm not counting that as the main event. And Ricochet.
And
yeah,
Ricochet.
Yeah. Which was awesome. So, while this was a really good match, I think it would probably be near the bottom of Gargano takeover matches.
I have mixed emotions on it. I thought the main event was, you know, both of us thought the main event was really good. We both enjoyed the main event. That's not really, most people are not debating whether the match was good or not, or even great, but I think it's the degrees of everything. And I think this match was, for me, the most consistently good of the three matches. Mm. In terms of, the first match, I still don't like the first fall very much, even though the rest of it is my favorite by far. I think that they have come close to matching the emotion of the second and third falls of their first match. So overall, I really really love this match. I probably liked it more than the second match. But I will say there are some elements that I think are fair to criticize in terms of, is it overkill? You know, and diminishing returns to a degree. I get it. I think I'm kind of, I thought they had a great match, but I'm over Cole and Gargano wrestling each other. They certainly need to stay apart for a long time now. And to a degree that I never got, and to your point, Nick, I never got there with Ciampa and Gargano. I could have watched Ciampa and Gargano wrestle each other a million times. And the last match, which a lot of people weren't as high on, I thought was better than any of the Cole and Gargano matches for me. Maybe the first one. I love that first match, but
yeah, I think the second match is the best match they've had.
But the regardless, it was still a great match. But it did feel, I don't know. There was something. It was as great as the match was. I thought it was spectacular. It did feel like it was missing something emotionally that their prior matches had. And I will say, I thought the second fall of this match might have been the best fall that they've had. I thought it was beautiful storytelling beginning to end, but that last fall was, as crazy as it was, really didn't do as much for me as it probably should have given all the gimmickry involved.
Right.
There were also storytelling decisions that I didn't understand. Like, I don't understand the physics of the, the physics in wrestling don't make sense anyway, but how would jumping off the ladder assist the Canadian Destroyer or Panama Sunrise?
I think the thought is that, like, it is adding additional force to the move. That it's like you're almost springboarding off the mat and then over. You know, so you come down harder, so you go up faster and
I guess
whip your opponent over. I mean, otherwise, why not just do the Canadian Destroyer and not do the middle rope thing? You know, taking it from the ladder, from the middle rope to the ladder, I think you could apply the same logic as, you know, taking it from the ground to the middle rope.
Yeah, I suppose. It just didn't, to me, I looked at that and I was like, well, that was kind of dumb. Contrarily, the Destroyer off of the rope or whatever that they did a few minutes later, I was like, I don't really ever want to see anybody kick out of that. But we've seen that in, I mean, the Canadian Destroyer at this point is a DDT, right? So,
I think that's kind of the argument that people are making is that a lot of finishers are devastating maneuvers in the context of these Cole Gargano matches have become DDTs. Like,
that is not specific to Cole and Gargano. We just watched the Lucha Brothers hit the Young Bucks with three Canadian Destroyers in a row and they kicked out.
That's true.
It's like what. At this, it's not a. My problem is when people act like this is a Johnny Gargano thing. It is a style of wrestling that is designed to pop the live crowd, and it works. I mean, it works for its intended purpose. And I think that, you know, for if you're watching at home, sometimes it does get to be a little like, wow, what? And again, the big problem comes for me in these matches where you see something super devastating and then something very simplistic finishes it.
Right.
After all that. And you're like, so we can kick out of a
Panama Sunrise onto the concrete.
Yeah.
That's still my one from this entire series where I just went, you know, why even? I mean, just don't do it. It's just such an unnecessary thing. But
that, you know, everything's situational, and I still loved the match. Thought it was great. My match of the night on TakeOver though was Candice and Io Shirai. That was to me there's always that match that's like, wow, this is the undercard match that sort of shocks you with how good it was. And I picked that match before the show as kind of my sleeper that would surprise people and steal the show. But I did not. I really didn't think it would steal the show. I thought it would be a really good match. I didn't think it would be the best match of the card. But for me, it ended up being my favorite match of the card. I thought it was really good. And that's the first time that I've seen Io Shirai and her new character, Nick. And nope. I was impressed.
Yes, as was I. No, I liked the match a lot as well. I think my match of the night was probably the triple threat, though, of the North American title match.
Gotcha. And see, that's a match that I'm lower on than consensus, because it took me until like the last 5 minutes to really get invested in that match. I don't know why. I'm still not sure why, but I, for whatever reason, I wasn't feeling that match as much as I expected to be, although I love all three competitors. Well, I love Strong, and I love The Dream, and I like Pete Dunne.
So, oh, what in the world? What is that?
I don't know. I've kind of come across – I've kind of started to think back and wonder if – the guy that I liked most in those matches was Tyler Bate rather than Pete Dunne, because as I've watched Pete Dunne since then, I don't know. He's good. He's really good. He's certainly really, really good.
You do tend to skew more towards the traditional white meat baby face than
I do. I like baby face wrestling better than I do heel wrestling. Always have, for the most part. I mean, I loved heels when I was a kid. But I like the entertaining heel, and also I feel like Pete Dunne goes to the well on stuff a lot. The finger break spot, he goes to the same kind of well a lot of times, and while it can be great, you know, I remember I didn't like that Walter match very much that everybody else went gaga over. I thought it was real good. Yeah, I thought it was good, but it was by far my least favorite match of the last TakeOver, and I don't think it was because of Walter. I think Pete Dunne as a babyface. And what it is Pete Dunne as a babyface. I think Pete Dunne as a heel is really good, but I don't like Pete Dunne as a babyface. And maybe I'll change my mind moving forward as we see that, but I kind of wish that he would go back to what I was first introduced to him, you know, a couple years ago as this kind of rotten Fit Finley style heel. And since then, it feels like they've turned him babyface, and he, you know, it's kind of like Finlay as a babyface. It's just weird to me.
Hmm. Interesting.
But nonetheless, SummerSlam was on Sunday. God. And
wrestling 30 minutes here.
Yeah, SummerSlam happened, and it was a good show, I thought, mostly.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I don't really have anything. I mean, even the bad stuff I've already forgotten about. So it's a show that didn't leave a bad taste in mouth. And somewhere there is an alternate universe where Dolph Ziggler is still being speared into oblivion by Goldberg.
Oh.
So, and that's the reality I most want to live in.
Nick, how much money would it take for us to put together to finance a weekly show where Dolph Ziggler just gets speared for 30 minutes every week?
By Goldberg, yep.
By
stands
Goldberg.
Up and just gets speared, yep.
And increasingly cartoonish. Like the third time he comes out and he does the running spear off the ropes, we need to find out more cartoonish ways to do it. Like the fourth time.
We would actually create a real life version of the old pinball bumpers from the Sonic the Hedgehog games. And Goldberg would bump off the pinball bumper and just destroy Dolph Ziggler with a spear. Yes.
Absolutely. And then all the women's matches were real good. Becky, Natty, and Charlotte, and Trish. And then the main event was spectacular with Brock and Seth.
But Brock sucks, Greg. Don't you know that?
I know. I've heard that from pretty reliable sources, Nick, that never changed their minds about anything. Nope. That Brock Lesnar's just old. He needs to go away.
Brock Lesnar sucks. He's unreliable. He phones it in. He doesn't care about the business.
And Seth Rollins is just unlikable.
Is unlikable.
He can't work. He couldn't work as Tyler Black, and he can't work now. Mm-hmm. So we should just write them both off. Anyway, Raw and SmackDown happened, but we don't want to belabor the point. It was a good week of wrestling. With that being said, Nick, my God, I think we're done. I think we're done in pretty good time on this episode.
We did, but speaking of time, Greg, you know, you and I mentioned earlier in the episode, we were talking about the 80s tournament. We were talking about, you know, certain country songs that involve the passage of time. And you and I aren't big fans of the Dolly Parton song 9 to 5, so Why not improve it? Why not take it and build upon the foundation that's there? See if we can't dress it up a little bit. And who better to do that, ladies and gentlemen, than WWE Hall of Famer Jim Ross. Jim, take it away.
Well, thank you very much, Nick. And I just want to say, you know, I talked to my co-host Conrad Thompson many times about this, that I believe work ethic is the most important thing that you can have in life. I learned that from the cowboy Bill Watts a long time ago. Now, here's a song about work ethic that I think everybody should listen to, you take a little bit of advice, and just apply it to their own lives. Tumble out of bed and I stumble in the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition. Yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Well, jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. You know why that blood's pumping? Because of Blue Chew. Blue Chew will get your blood flowing no matter how old you are, no matter how clogged your arteries are. Your blood will pump down to a certain region of your body while you're in the shower, while you're getting ready for bed, while you are getting ready to do the horizontal mambo with whoever it is that you're with. Anyway, out on the street, the traffic starts jumping with folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. I'm working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. I used to get paid in hot dogs, folks. And in fact, one time I was paid in a hot dog and a Coke, and the promoter came up to me and he said, "That'll be a quarter." Anyway, they just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy if you let it. 9 to 5 for service and devotion. You would think that I would deserve a fat promotion. After all, I did assemble what some have called the greatest collection of talent in the history of this industry in the Attitude Era. I'm the one that put that together, by the way, not Brucey. I put that together. Want to move ahead, but the boss won't seem to let me. Oh, McMahon has some interesting tendencies. I remember one time we were riding in the car, and McMahon let out the most heinous, foul-smelling fart this side of Robert Gibson. It burned the nostrils. But did I sell it? Hell no. Because the worst thing you can do to the old man is sell it. So I no-sold. I just kept driving. Didn't even look in his direction. And he got increasingly angry as this drive progressed. McMahon was so pissed, I thought he was going to murder me. Instead, he would just humiliate me. I swear, sometimes that man's ass is out to get me. They let you dream just to watch him shatter. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder. And you know, the big boss man climbed the ladder of success in this industry. He was Ray Traylor, he was Big Bubba, he was Big Boss Man, Guardian Angel, the man, the boss, everything under the sun. Long, storied career. He brought a bicycle onto WCW Saturday Night. But anyway, you got dreams he'll never take away. You're in the same boat with a lot of your friends, a lot of your coworkers, a lot of the boys, waiting for the day your ship will come in. And the tide's going to turn and it's all going to roll your way. Your ass is going to be working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living. You'll be barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving, no selling at all. It's all taking. All you're worried about is getting your shit in. Barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and you never get the credit. It is enough to drive you goofier than a pet coon if you let it. 9 to 5, they've got your ass right where they want you. There's a better life, and you dream about it, don't you? It's a rich man's game, no matter what they call it. It's about the money, folks. It's about dollars and miles. And you spend your life putting money in that old man's wallet. 9 to 5, whoa! What a way to make a living. Barely getting by. It's all taken, no selling. They just use your mind, and they never give you credit. Even if you're a great mind for this business, you don't get credit for it anymore. It's enough to drive your ass crazy if you let it. That's why it's important you don't let it. You just got to let it go, folks. Anyway, I'm skipping over some stuff here. The bottom line here is you're spending your life putting money in the old man's wallet. 9 to 5, he is working your ass. 9, well, all the way to 5.
Arm traveling fanboys.